Good morning, everyone. I am going to try to start so we can, as early in the week as possible, get in a pattern of starting on time, because we have so many things that we all hope to cover together. I want to, again, just make a few announcements, as I will be as brief as I can. Again, a reminder to look at your schedule each day and also to be alert at these morning sessions, and we have someone in the other plenary as well, making announcements that are right up to the minute. For example, today in the tutorials at 10:15, we have to do a room change because of audiovisual needs of one of our speakers. So let me just mention it involves two of our overseas guests, and they're both going to be remarkable if you still haven't made up your mind. The presentation on Kitsch and the Crisis of the West, Rob Riemann, a remarkable Dutch philosopher and art critic, is now going to be speaking in Lauder. And Lord John Alderdice, an extraordinary man who is both a psychiatrist and a diplomat and a politician, is going to speak about his unique insights into terrorizing and terror. And he has experience in Northern Ireland as well as elsewhere in the world. He's going to be speaking in the Marble Garden tent. But everything else scheduled for this morning is as is. A reminder that there are some things that are now on the calendar that were not when you all planned your days. The session on religion in the world with Madeleine Albright and Reverend Peter Gomes. And also Michael York is going to be discussing Shakespeare from an actor's point of view. Those are this afternoon at 2:15. They've been added. And we also have an evening exchange that was not in your original program. Liberalism in America, and that's going to be at 9:30 tonight in the Jerome Hotel Ballroom, and that ballroom is large enough that I think we probably have plenty of seats, even if you haven't planned and would like to do that. Reminder that if you want to go to one of the breakfast sessions, please sign up in advance. We had a few issues this morning, and that's to be expected, but we do ask you to sign up in advance for any of those. Lunch today is going to be served just after the tutorials, either in the tent we were in last evening, in the patio in the Koch building, which is right outside here, or the tent where the reception was in Pepke. We also have a new feature this afternoon to look for after the afternoon tutorials. We're going to have book signings and opportunities for informal questions and answers. Those are in your program. And they'll also be in something called the Idealog, which is our little daily newspaper, which I think was not ready this morning when you came in, but it will be ready when you go out if you don't already have it, and we'll have a series of reminders. And finally, want to mention that there is a free concert tonight. It's a wonderful thing, open to everyone in Aspen. It's the traditional 4th of July concert with the Aspen Festival Orchestra. It's at 7 o'clock, and it's one of those few ones in the music tent where no ticket is necessary, but we hope very much that you will enjoy it. I think those are all the announcements for this morning, and with that, I simply am going to turn things over to David Bradley, who will introduce his panel and begin our conversation. David.
Thank you, Elliot. Can you hear me? Am I adequately mic'd for you? My name is David Bradley. I'm the owner of the Atlantic Monthly and a few modest policy and political publications. January 1993, Inauguration Day, Washington Post ran this story, Dan Quayle was about to be inaugurated as vice president. And in the few hours of the morning before the inauguration ceremony, he wanted to have his last chance to go out and be among the people. So he went to what used to be a Roy Rogers restaurant in Upper Northwest Washington, and he went through the line, bought his food, came back to the table, and then turned to the woman to his right and said, "Hi, my name's Dan Quayle." "Hi," she responded, "I'm your Secret Service agent." Vintage Dan Quayle. It's three parts courtesy for every one part cunning. You'll see the application here. I am all courtesy, and as to education, I am no cunning at all. I'm not an educator, and so my task up here is to pleasantly guide the group through a conversation, and I'd like to do so. Let me introduce the three guests, and then I'll give you a roadmap for how we thought we might proceed, and then head right into the conversation. To my immediate right is Joel Klein. For many, public school education is almost a belief system. It's that, at its best, that fantastic leveler in a democracy that takes everyone from any station and launches him or her to a full chance of participation. If you were looking for one human being to personify the best of public education and its thrust of a great person to the American dream, I think it would be very hard to find someone better to that appointment than Joel Klein. Joel is the son of a postman, and his mother is a bookkeeper. He was raised in Queens Projects. He went to a New York City public school, Bryant High. And there the story, as he finishes high school, becomes like the story of anyone you might have seen at Exeter or Andover or Choate, who had the best launch of all. Columbia University undergrad, Harvard Law School, Supreme Court clerk, private practice in Washington, including a heavy Supreme Court practice, deputy White House counsel under President Clinton, then appointed as the president's assistant attorney general for antitrust. When the administration turned over, he went to Bertelsmann and ran one of the divisions for Bertelsmann, large German publisher, and then was coaxed by Mayor Michael Bloomberg to come in and be the chancellor of the New York City public school system. As to pure political courage, I don't know if there is a more daring posting in the United States. There are 1.1 million students in the New York City public school system. There are over 400,000 on staff. It's $15 billion in budget. 70% of the students are, by some definition, disadvantaged. To Joel's right is Tony Marks. Tony is the president of Amherst College. The story of Abraham in the Old Testament begins with the oddest thing. The Lord calls Abraham out. He just says, come out and come forth. Doesn't say where he's to go or what he's to do. And Abraham picks up his people and heads out and over time becomes the founder of the Lord's nations. So I want you to picture Tony Marks about 3 years ago sitting at his desk. He's a tenured professor at Columbia University in political science. And he's done all the Stations of the Cross of academia. Yale undergrad, Princeton PhD, had done the tenure track at Columbia. And then he receives an email from a friend. And I'm going to read to you the Business Week coverage of this. I was minding my own business as a Columbia University political science professor in 2002 when a friend who was an Amherst College alum put my name in the hopper to be president of Amherst. I wrote back, this is very nice, but I've never been a chairman, a dean, or a provost, and besides, I didn't go to Amherst. Amherst search committee rightly put his name aside, but then having gone through others and not finding whom they wanted, they invited him for the interview. Here's Business Week continuing. When Marx finally met the committee, he made an impassioned appeal. Elite U.S. colleges such as Amherst, he said, are perpetuating deep inequalities in American society. They equate success with serving the privileged elite and have largely abandoned talented youth from poor families. This deepens the country's growing class divisions and exacerbates the long-term decline in economic and social mobility. Feeling he had nothing to lose, since he hadn't sought the job, Marx exhorted the trustees to tackle the problem head-on. Here I'm quoting, I'm not interested in being a custodian over a privileged place. He remembers telling a gathering of wealthy alums and academic stars that day. We were blown away by Marx, says the incoming board chair of Amherst. And at age 46, he became the youngest president of Amherst College. And then began the Marx era. We will see how it turns out, but as to radical reform, as to ambition, it's a remarkable story. And I'm going to ask him to tell a few minutes of it in just a moment. And to Tony's right is Governor Gaston Caperton. Of the great two-term moderate southern state governors who massively influenced their parties and their states, this is the one about whom there is no contention whatsoever. Everyone loves Gaston Caperton. UNC grad, entrepreneur who just made it large very early in life and freed him up to do a larger work early. 1988 to 1996, he was the governor of West Virginia, known for two things, both for an education agenda and for rescuing what you would understand to be the bankrupt fiscal circumstances of the state. After he left in 96, he began his education run. He went to Harvard's Institute of Politics, put a little time there, taught at Columbia, and then in 1999 became president of the College Board. Read SATs, APs, and so forth. This is not what he wanted me to say, but it is under Gaston's tenure that the introduction of mandatory written essays became part of the SATs. Remarkably thoughtful gesture. It still shows the politician in him. If you have children or grandchildren who are taking the SATs and you would like to pass down a business card, he has offered to personally grade their essays. So here's my thought on roadmapping the conversation. The panelists have been chosen because they're educators, but principally because they are pretty aggressive reformers against an old system. So what I thought I'd ask each to do is spend 5 minutes and tell the hard reform thing he is doing. And if he's willing to, I'd love to hear just a little bit of what's hard about it, where was the contention, where was the moment of drama. And then we will lift up from these three stories, treating them like factual basis, and tend to the larger policy issues that this group knows as any soldier in the field. Can we start with you, Joel?
Sure. First, let me give my card to Gaston. Well, thank you very much. It's really a privilege to be here. And like you, David, I am not a career educator. It was because of Michael Bloomberg that I took on this assignment, and also my deep belief that public education in the United States was failing significant numbers of our kids, and particularly the kids that Tony was talking about up at Amherst, that is kids of color, kids who grow up in poverty. And for me, it was because the mayor did what he did that made possible what we're trying to do in New York City, which is to actually transform the educational system. Everybody knows A Nation at Risk. Everybody knows Brown versus Board. And yet, despite Brown versus Board and A Nation at Risk, I think it fairly could be said in America today that we're not remotely providing an equal educational opportunity to kids, and our nation is still at risk some 25 years after Nation at Risk was first published. What Bloomberg did was actually, through his own tour de force, put in place, I think, something that may be a key to educational transformation. Most school districts run by boards and divided authority and are designed pretty much to maintain the status quo, which in a lot of instances is probably fine in a lot of organizations, but the status quo...
It's probably this.
We have time. Go ahead.
Can we listen in?
Actually, somebody said, do you want to be president of Amherst? They're going to put my name in there. I just wanted to read the email.
Are they looking?
But in K-12 education, the status quo doesn't work. Let me give you one statistic just that we inherited, which was in our city, about 1 out of 10 black or Latino children gets a Regents diploma. And a Regents diploma pretty much certifies you're college ready. So if you think about 9 out of 10 kids going through the system and are not prepared at the time they exited for college. And what Bloomberg decided was he was, as mayor, going to take control of this thing. Nobody thought he could do it. He did it. And he's made enormously tough decisions in the transformation. Decisions that are not politically popular a lot of times, but that are absolutely necessary. The system is built on all the kind of things that don't work. So we have massive regulation. The federal government regulates us, the state regulates us, the city regulates us, and the union contracts regulate us. It's a system of almost sort of a maintenance of the status quo through labyrinthian regulation. What we've gone about doing, and we've taken the fight at every level, is fundamentally to see if we can replace this highly regulatory, politically accountable system with a performance-based system in which you can begin to address the problems of, for example, an inequitable distribution of human talent in the system. So if you look at the New York Times editorial today called Teachers Matters, we all know that, but the truth of the matter is there's vast inequities in the distribution of teaching talent within the city of New York, and a lot of that is dictated by the structure of the civil service system, which fundamentally says to people the only thing I can give you is an easier job, a less challenging job. If we ever ran the police force the way we ran the public school systems, it wouldn't work. If you didn't have the ability to deploy your human talent where the needs are greatest, it wouldn't work. And so for a little bit of drama, we went through about 2 years of knockdown, dragout, and renegotiating our contract with the teachers union. And the fundamental, in my view, the fundamental zeitgeist of the union contract had been life tenure. This almost sounds like a university. Lockstep pay and seniority. And those three pillars, in my view, are pillars of mediocrity and tend to, in a sense, move people through the system without any perception, ultimately, of the rest of the system. And it was really quite dramatic. There were rallies against us in Madison Square Garden, gives you some sense of the magnitude of the issues. And at the end of it, came up with a contract that I think will begin to actually transform the system. For the first time, some 3,000 teachers used to just show up at your school. Imagine this, if you show up at Amherst and said, I'm here, I've got a seniority right to a position, nobody can interview, ask me questions. 3,000 of them used to move through the system, almost all of them ending up in schools that are high-need schools. So fundamentally, these are teachers that nobody wanted that migrate the system and end up where our neediest kids are. That has been changed. For the first time, we introduced pay differentials, not as far as I'd like to go, but that is important. If you're going to say to somebody, I've got a real challenge for you in Bed-Stuy or East New York or Harlem or the South Bronx, don't kid yourself, money matters. Not only do teachers matter, money matters. And people are beginning to respond to these positions, and we're bringing talent to high-needs communities. We're using it to recruit math and science teachers from all over the country by giving them a $15,000 signing bonus. And then we did the same thing with our principals, and we had the same kind of knockdown drag out because, again, principalship is thought as a life tenure. All of them are thought of as equal when it's preposterous to think of people that way. All our university presidents are not equal. All our university faculty are not equal, and all of our principals are not equal. And for the first time in New York City this year, 320 principals, that's about 23% of our principals, signed an actual performance agreement in terms of student performance. They voluntarily signed it over the objection of their union. So while we work on all of the curriculum and all of the class size and all the other issues for important education, under Bloomberg's leadership, we are really trying to transform the way you manage the system, the accountability is moving from political to performance-based, and in the end, seeing if we can take that 1 in 10 kids and dramatically, and I mean dramatically, change. And the more kids I get ready for college, the easier the work that Tony and his colleagues are going to have to do.
Thank you, Joel. Tony?
Well, first, thank you, and I want to thank Joel as a native New Yorker and product of the New York City public schools for your efforts. When I hear you give speeches, Joel, in which you talk about my kids, that actually, I think, says it all. In a society where we tend to focus on our kids narrowly constrained, we need to start thinking socially and seriously about all our kids needing to have the opportunities to succeed, and the public education system is clearly the crucial element of that. Amherst is different than the New York City public school system. We have 420 kids a year. We only do undergraduates. We spend $300,000 per student to educate them at Amherst. Half of our students pay about half of that amount. The other half of our students are subsidized, sometimes by the entire amount of $300,000 a year. You have to ask yourself, what is the value added for society of that kind of a large and focused investment? And the institution asks itself this question. The trustees asked the question. It was a question that I was brought in to join the conversation of. And I think that the answer that we believe is we are in the business not just of educating our students to be players in the economy, to be responsible citizens, those are essential, but also to be leaders, that's the value added for the society that makes that level of investment worthwhile. And that's the project we've been engaged in the 3 years that I've been at Amherst, of trying to think of what that means. And the first thing it means is we shouldn't be complacent. We're one of the best liberal arts colleges in America, and that actually is as much a problem as a strength in terms of talking about moving. There isn't an agreement that Amherst is broken. It is not broken. And yet, if we're going to ensure that we are in using that large investment well, we have to push further. We have to push against the sense of entitlement, the sense of complacency, and I'm not just talking about amongst our students. We have to think about ways in which the institution not only educates our own students, but can be a leader in higher education more generally, to resist the ways in which the system has been created, yes, to provide opportunity, the SAT, et cetera, was invented for that reason, but ways in which we actually preserve privilege and hide it behind the image of meritocracy. Those conversations over the last 3 years have led us on several fronts to address this issue. The curriculum is essential. The faculty at Amherst has now voted to add requirement, or at least the first requirement, in 40 years. We've now created a new system where we will allocate the investment in future faculty positions no longer dependent upon each department vying for their own silos' interest, but asking the faculty as a corporate whole to set the agenda, the priorities for education of all students at Amherst, and then we will allocate faculty positions accordingly. That's a sea change for an institution that was built on the assumption of each individual entrepreneur, if you will, as an academic, pursuing their own interest. Now we're trying to be more responsible about this investment, thinking about the education as a whole. We've even, the faculty has now agreed, a la the issues that Joel was raising, for the first time to allow itself to be evaluated in terms of its teaching post-tenure. Those are hard structural changes in a place where complacency and entitlement is not only a problem for our students. We also we're about to announce one of the largest grants in the history of the college that will enable us to say to every student, we expect you to do some service and some work while you're at Amherst. We'll connect that to to internships and to the curriculum. We hope to partner with K-12 institutions in our vicinity so that we can use those efforts to create the next generation of leaders that will address the problems that Joel and his colleagues have been wrestling with. But it is the issue of access that has certainly gotten us the most media attention. And I think there are two fundamental reasons why we are concerned about this. One is if our net, we get a ridiculous number of applications for a small number of spaces. In some sense, you should say, why are we eager for more applications? And the answer is, if our net is constrained in terms of who applies and who we admit, then we cannot be finding talent when we select the best. And in fact, we have a financial system that is designed to have the opposite of that outcome. We have a ridiculously high sticker price that camouflages the fact that half the kids who pay that sticker price are being subsidized by the college to an equal amount, and at the same time scares off students who can't imagine that they would feel at home at Amherst, excuse me, or that they could afford Amherst or a place like Amherst. So our talent base is being constrained. And perhaps more fundamentally, when we reinforce a system of access to the best institutions in higher education that rewards previous privilege, that is in effect rigged to further that privilege, then what lessons are we teaching in terms of not just mobility, but in terms of justice? And if you think about the education system of the country, in which unequal funding ensures that those who need extra help get less help by communities, and then reinforced after K-12 in terms of rewarding privilege in the application process, then the education system as a whole is teaching the opposite lesson to all of our students than the lesson that we need to be teaching. Amherst has been addressing this. We've asked our students to get involved in terms of outreach. I'd be delighted to talk about ways we do that with faculty, with alumni. The simple fact is, this year, quietly, we have moved from 15% of our incoming class eligible for Pell Grants, which is bottom 40% of the economy, in 1 year, and that number is twice the percentage of most of our Ivy peer institutions, went up to 20%. But what's more interesting about the incoming class is we've moved the needle in terms of access without compromising academic standings. The SATs, other measures have not budged, nor have we found that the trade-off that the mass media would have you assume is there is in fact not there. We have increased our minority percentages, and we are leader in higher education in that regard already. Our legacy admits also went up this year. One of the powerful lessons is that on a small scale, in a no doubt elite and privileged place, that we can actually be more responsible without sacrificing our standards, without pitting one group against another. And there is a sort of assumption in society that you can't do that. So I think it's important for us to make clear that you can. The fact is, what happens at Amherst isn't going to affect the world in the largest sense. We are a small place. But we hope, because we can move based on our scale, that we can move the high end of higher education, that we can provide some leadership, that we can demonstrate as educational institutions that we are prepared to act in the social interest that makes reasonable the level of investment in each student rather than in our self-interest. And that has not been the trajectory in higher education as we compete with each other. And it's time for us to say that we can't meet the challenges of society if each institution, particularly the leading institutions that get so much play, continue simply to look out for their self-interest in competing with each other and not pay attention to the social interest that is the basis for the investment in us over a very long period of time.
Thank you, Tony. Governor.
Thank you. You probably are surprised that I didn't go to inner city New York schools with my accent.
Never too late, Jackson.
But I'm deeply honored to be with these two gentlemen who I have known. Joel, I didn't know Tony until today, but they're really two of the great people in American education, so I'm proud to be here. My education really began in the fourth grade when my parents got a call from my fourth grade teacher saying that I didn't know how to read. My father took me to an eye doctor because he thought something must be wrong with my eyes, because my older sister never made anything but A's, and they weren't quite used to something like this happening in their family. And the doctor said that I didn't have anything wrong with my eyes. I had reversal, which was dyslexia. So school was pretty tough for me. My dad taught me how to read. Every morning when we get up before I go to school, I'd read this book of words, a dictionary, where he would make me memorize how to read it, how to spell it, which is really hard, and to know what the word meant. That's really how I began my education. My mom always said that I was as smart as my sister, but in a different way. Now, I didn't believe that, and she didn't believe that. When I graduated from college, I had to get a C in one course to have a point average to graduate, and my mom and dad came down. And my mom was so excited when I told her that I was graduating. And my dad said to her, "Don't act so surprised." You see, she really didn't believe what she said. But that really brought a passion for me to care deeply about education. For two reasons, I got a great education. One, I had a great teacher. My father was my first teacher, and he was a great teacher. And number two, my mom gave me a great attitude. And so when I was in business for 25 years and decided to run for governor, the polls told me I shouldn't. I had 3% on the first poll. And I asked the pollster what that meant. He said, "Zero. Everybody's got 3%. So I did something that is against all rules in politics when I was elected, and I was very lucky to get elected. I raised taxes, and I cut expenses. When you cut expenses out of government, you don't make anybody happy, and when you raise taxes, you make everybody mad. But I believe that if we were going to do an education in West Virginia, what I believe we could and should do, I had to do that. And I'm proud of what we were able to accomplish. We took teacher salaries from 49th to 31st. We put 70% of our kids in new and improved schools. We had the best computer program in the country. And if you look at where we went from, we used to say, I see a good friend of mine here from Mississippi. We used to say, thank God for Mississippi, because they were the only one doing as bad as we were. But we took ourselves up about halfway up by the time I left. So I was very proud about that. And one day I got when I was at Columbia, I got a call from somebody that said, would I like to be interviewed for the job as president of the college board? And I said, both my kids have taken that test and I've taken that test. Why would I want to run a testing company? Well, some of y'all know what I mean. So when I found out what the college board can do, was doing with the various programs they had, I felt like it was a great place to reform education. Because you can't change education unless you can infect it. And I thought there was enough there to do that. We're a not-for-profit membership organization of 5,000 colleges and schools. And so I interviewed for the job. And now I have to tell you, the second interview, I decided I really wanted this job. I'm pretty competitive. And you know how something can just fall, all of a sudden just pops in your brain when you're at an important place in your life? Well, I thought, as they were interviewing me, and I knew they had a lot of other good candidates, I said, do you think they're going to check my SAT scores? Now, if you're dyslexic, you don't want them to check your SAT scores. Well, I got through that, luckily, I can say. But my big challenge at the College Board was to turn it around from a gate to a gateway. I believe, as these two gentlemen do, that every student in America should have an equal opportunity to get an education. And so we have democratized the AP program, which used to be a program where the best teachers found the best students. We began to find out how we could test in kids into those programs, and we've been able to double that program. We've also believed in excellence, and so we've done things like bring Chinese into the AP program, and fortunately gotten a lot of support from a lot of people on Chinese. We put writing on the SAT because American kids don't know how to write very well, and we think all students should be able to write. So we have been fortunate to make a lot of changes at the College Board and really open up the door to more and more students to have opportunity. We will have this fall we'll have six schools in, small schools that we're running in New York City in very difficult neighborhoods. We'll have 20 schools across the country. That's a brand new thing for us, but we felt that it was important for us to actually get in and do that kind of work so we better knew how to tell other people and help other people and to change our programs and products that would help. So the College Board's mission is about excellence and excellence and equity, and we believe you can have both, and we must in America if we're going to have a great future. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Let's do a couple of macro questions, and then we'll open it up for you all to ask more pointed questions. It's a Joel kind of question, but you're all three such good minds. Let me start with Joel, but ask you each other on that. So it's been a long time. We've thought inner-city education was inadequate for a long time. If you take the benchmark of just suburban education in the country, are we ever going to reverse this problem? Or are we ever going to get public school, urban public school education to what we'd consider a pretty darn good standard? And what's the root cause you've got to break? Or what's the root cause you have to reach? What's the thing you've got to break to change this?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think we will. Indeed, I think we must. You know, it used to be, for me, a moral issue, this great divide, this achievement gap in education in the United States. But it's no longer simply a moral issue. It's an economic issue for the country. And I think if you look ahead to the the competitive pressures of the next several decades. I think finally the impetus, at least, is there, and I think you're seeing the kind of things that people like Bloomberg are doing. Much to his credit, the new mayor of Los Angeles also went after mayoral control. Are we going to be the same as the suburbs? It seems to me that's devoutly to be wished for, but, you know, they spend a lot more money per pupil. You've got to deal with the economic realities. Their kids come to the school system with a lot more opportunity. I mean, you know, Gaston talked about his family and all of that. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about, are we going to be as good as? I spend a lot of time worrying whether we'll be good enough for our kids, and I think we can do that, and I think we will do that. What's going to have to happen? To me, you're going to have to transform an excuse-based culture to a performance-based culture. Organizations that succeed are those that believe in problem-solving and tackling. When I started the school system, everybody said, well, Chancellor, it's the kids, it's this, it's that. Half the people in this audience probably would tell me you'll never fix urban education until you fix poverty in America. And I believe it's just exactly the other way around. I think you'll never fix poverty in America until we fix urban education. Is it going to be easy? Of course not. There are going to be financial issues we have to tackle. There are going to be human resource issues we're going to have to tackle. And we're going to have to adopt a model that doesn't say that virtually, if you think about Gulliver and the Lilliputians, virtually everything in education is somebody trying to tie you down so that the kind of things, you know, you were mentioning Jim Barksdale from Mississippi, and they're doing a lot better. Well, you know, Jim Barksdale and his team created Netscape, right? The kind, in my world, there's no entrepreneurialism. Innovation is not rewarded. The kind of things that make going to work exciting are often undermined by this very webbed-up, labyrinthian approach. And if we just have to, all we've got to do is figure out how to transform that. And I think
when you're driving home alone at night, as if that ever happened, do you really think the tide is going with you?
Yes. Okay. I took the job for one reason. I believe the mayor of New York is a remarkable asset in terms of he understood the priority and is unafraid of the politics. And, you know, the criticism on us is that we are not as politically responsive as people would like us to see. I don't view that as a criticism. One example. It's very powerful. The mayor decided he was going to say nobody can go to the fourth grade unless they could get level two on our reading test. Level two just means you can put the ball in play. It doesn't mean you're hitting home runs, right? If you get level one, it means you can't read. You know, so we in New York City, we kept pushing these kids through. They couldn't read. I go to high schools today, thousands of kids who can't read. You say, what have you been doing here all day? I mean, you can't read. I'm not saying you don't understand. You can't decode. So Mike said, nobody's going forward unless they get a level two. All hell broke loose. We have a panel which eight of the 13 people are appointed by the mayor. Two of his appointees were going to vote against him. Right before the meeting, he fired him. Under the law, he fired him. Under the law, they serve at the pleasure of the mayor. And the mayor said, they serve at my pleasure. They no longer please me. Goodbye. Right? Unheard of. I'll never forget. I had that meeting that night with two new people who had been on it. We got the thing done by, you know, an 8-6 vote or whatever it was. And I never forget, my wife had a double martini waiting for me. I was on the front page of the New York Times. It looked like I just, you know, like the doe in a headline. But that's what leadership is about. And it seemed to me the key to him and the key to the city was we'd have two terms. And the day I arrived, everybody told me, you know, Chancellor, the average tenure is about 2.5 years. And there was a reason they were telling me that. And as soon as I exceeded it, they never failed to remind me that the average was 2.5 years. What Mike has made possible in New York is a two-term mayor and a two-term chancellor line willing to take the heat. And I am actually quite optimistic. Our graduation rates have gone up over 4 years by 8%. We still have miles to go. But much more importantly, the cultural changes. 320 people sign a contract saying that if I don't get good results, you can remove me. And indeed, if we don't get good results, you can shut down my school. That didn't happen 5 years in urban education.
Gaston, tell me.
What's the question, sir?
How optimistic are you that it actually will get changed?
I'm very optimistic. I think you see two people like this, you have to be optimistic. They have the values. They understand the need to give all children an opportunity. So I believe that in our schools that we're running we have just a very small job compared to what the chancellor has. But we go in with an attitude of high expectations and hard work. We believe that for schools to be good, you got to have high expectations for the teachers, for the leader of the school, and for the students themselves. And you could create an atmosphere of that in the school system. So I think that American education, it really understands today more than it ever has. The thing that concerns me the most is that we are not paying teachers what we should pay them in order to attract them to come into the schools. We will lose 2 million teachers in the next 5 years in this country. And it's difficult to attract the best and the brightest into your school systems when you don't have a competitive pay system. You don't necessarily give them the atmosphere that they can be successful. And I think that's the thing that concerns me the most. And I think America has got to wake up, really wake up to the fact that none of us, nobody in this room can say that they were successful except that they point to a teacher that inspired them or taught them to be successful. So I think that's one of the things we have to worry about.
Well, I like to be an optimist, and I certainly see signs to be an optimist, but I think let's not underestimate the challenges here. First, it's not just about urban or minority education. At Amherst, one of the most selective places in the land, we have students who have trouble based on their preparation, which is really quite a shocking statement if you think about it, from across the board. And even the best middle-class suburban kids are increasingly being trained to the test and having a hard time thinking for themselves. And we're in the business of getting students to think for themselves. And in a sense, we now have to counter the socialization of the process before us. Go back to the basic question is American society ready to think of all of our children as all of our children? One of the things that I see, and I understand, I'm a parent, is the passion we bring to our own children's interests, whether it be getting into the right school in the New York City system or getting the right SAT so you can go on to the right college. You don't see the same passion for everybody's children. And in fact, I would say if you look at the last 50 years of American society, we have constructed things in a way to purposefully build barriers. In some sense, the suburbanization of America was about protecting our children and not having to be responsible for theirs. So you have different districts, different financial systems. If we spend 10 times as much on the wealthiest suburban school student as we do on, you know, the least well-funded, of course we shouldn't be surprised by the results. And yet we do live in a society that that sometimes seems like social Darwinism on steroids, that we sort of reinforce the inequality and assume that when people fail, it's their fault. And there's a rich tradition of this in the social sciences and in public policy. And all of the efforts that we're talking about are trying to resist those social assumptions. And they are dangerous ones for this society, for its economy, and its democracy.
It's a very important point that needs underscoring. There's something unique about education that's different from lots of other social services that Tony is touching upon here. Everybody in this room, whatever else your worries are, your kid is going to get an education in the United States. Whether the kid wants an education, different story. But your kid is going to get an education, you know. And on the other hand, so if you think about a police force, right, wherever you live, northeast, south, or west of Central Park, you want to make sure your safety is protected. So you have a community investment in a high-quality police force. But the community doesn't have the same either financial or moral investment in a high-quality education system. So imagine a different world. And whenever I say this, people giggle. It makes them it's so uncomfortable. Imagine a world in which all the people in this room, I could assign their kids randomly to schools in New York City. You couldn't pick your neighborhood school and you couldn't go to private school. In that world, people here would be revolutionized. You would not tolerate what goes on in public education today. And that's the point.
That's a fantastic way to think of it.
It's very powerful when you think of it that way.
the Supreme Court suggests this heuristic device is not likely to happen.
Right. No. No. My advice is never. Warren Buffett proposed it. This is his week. He said one of the great mistakes was the Supreme Court's two decisions saying that private schools were constitutional right in the United States. I've got enough on my plate to take on those constitutional issues right now. But it's at least as a way to think about the problem. Truly think about if your kid had to go to public school and indeed was randomly assigned to the public schools in New York City, whether you would tolerate it.
It's a Rawlsian notion of education.
Absolutely. It's a total Rawlsian notion.
That's right.
Exactly.
Are you game to start carrying the conversation? Anyone have some questions want to lead off with? Please.
The shortage of teachers is constantly mentioned, but the requirements of a graduate engineer with a PhD who is a nuclear scientist and has been training young men in his company for many years is not qualified to teach in the city of New York. Am I correct?
That's correct. But it's correct and also...
The
question is, given there's a shortage of teachers, nevertheless, a nuclear physicist or a nuclear engineer with a PhD can't teach in New York City because she doesn't meet the certification qualifications. I think in the end, you know, this is a real problem, but one we can fix pretty easily. Certification came about to make sure that teaching wasn't a patronized job. So you had to at least jump over a minimalist hurdle. In my view, that's part of the whole regulatory mindset that we need to get by. What people ought to be telling the likes of me is here are the criteria, the performance you need to meet. And if you don't, we'll fire you, which is just fine with me. And then let me decide if I can get nuclear engineers and all the other people in the world how to staff my schools. But we have exactly the opposite model, which is we set minimum thresholds in order to protect against all of the bad things. We ought to, if we continue that model, we'll continue to get minimal results. If we decide instead to have a model that allows people to reach for their highest potentials, to be creative in the way we think about it. So, for example, you know, at one point somebody proposed as a way to get more teachers, reorganize the way we teach. We have everything by lockstep class size, 25 to 1, this, and that. And Amherst, they don't do that. And we shouldn't do that. We ought to have some lecture class. We ought to think about using our money to attract, put more money on the table, as Gaston says. But you can't do that if everything is so rigid. And the example you give is one of what I think are thousands of dysfunctional rules to protect us against our worst instincts.
Yes, we have a real crisis about math and science students. I mean teachers, math and science teachers. And that can be overcome, and we've got to start using people that are in industry today as part-time teachers. And rather than to say that as a barrier, we've got to change that barrier, and it can be changed.
Ma'am. Tony, you want to field it and want to repeat the question?
The question is, how can America be, what would it take for Americans to realize that we have to even have a commitment to universal pre-K education, that you have to start all the way at the beginning? And, you know, I think we need to be having these conversations and understanding that education is actually a web. It's, you know, it's not the question of universities or K through 12 or pre-K, it's all of it together. And, you know, I think perhaps Americans will understand this based on economic self-interest, even if they haven't quite understood it based on democratic interest. We will see whether we come to that point or not. Can I just say to the previous question also, it's interesting that at Amherst and places like Amherst, Teach for America is now the single largest employer of our graduates. That says something about the commitment here. But the fact is and I hope Wendy's, well, I know Wendy's here somewhere, but the fact is, you know, we need to honor teachers. We need to pay them responsibly. We need to hold them accountable, surely. But we also need to treat them with respect. We need to make sure that this is, while we, there is a broader base of talent for the teaching pool than we may be reaching because of regulations, there is also a skill and an expertise of teaching, and there are people who have learned it over a lifetime, and we need to respect that and learn from that. It's not simply you can throw anybody into a classroom and expect that it's going to work. It's not that simple, though it, you know, we certainly need more talent in the classroom.
But it goes to a point, I totally agree with this, but it goes to a point, everybody says, well, there's this massive attrition of teachers, and but again, it's not equitably distributed in the system. I have schools in New York City in which there's very little teacher turnover, and the same, we think of teachers as an undifferentiated group, and that's a huge mistake. No group works if you don't differentiate. And so I've got some high-need schools in which teachers turn over every couple of years. They've got a 50% attrit rate. And then I've got some other schools in which the teachers, you know, are very stable. If we don't start to think about how you build an environment to keep people in high-need schools and how you incent people of talent to go there, then you're not going to be able, you can't do this by cheerleading it. You've got to do it by changing the facts on the ground.
Go ahead, please.
My name is Susan Crown. I'm from Chicago, the state that has the dubious distinction of being 49th out of 50th in the per pupil allocation in the public school system. I would like to ask about the competitive factor in improving the schools, charter schools, contract schools. There are so many institutional snares, labyrinths, and paradoxes that some of these things can't be worked out of the system. But bringing in charter schools and contract schools and true competitors, and perhaps even allowing parents or families to choose where their kids go to school, thereby building in a meritocracy, and I don't mean to use the voucher word, but it's one that's out there. I just sort of like to know your perspective on what the healthy competitive environment is to improve the overall quality of public schools.
Well, as a person who sued the largest private monopoly in America, now running the largest public monopoly in America, I should probably answer your question. I think we ought to infuse as much competition in the system. I'm an unalloyed fan of charter schools. Unfortunately, the cap in New York City has not... New York State hasn't been lifted, which is really politics as usual, even though we've got some charters that are doing extraordinary things. We just signed a contract performance agreement with an organization to run basically 20 schools that we have within a network that they're doing. I think we need to do much more of this kind of thing in America. I don't think it's a panacea, but I think it'll infuse more entrepreneurialism. The thing that when you mentioned Wendy Kopp, the thing that's so important about Teach for America is not just that they're bringing teachers to the system. They're bringing a small percentage of the teachers. They're bringing a huge percentage of the entrepreneurs to the system, and that's absolutely critical for transformation.
Can I just add, I assume the chancellor would agree, choice is essential, and all parents feel passionately about their kids', you know, education and should be able to exert that choice. The key is there should be good choices.
Absolutely.
Right? Choice doesn't solve it unless the choices are what they need to be for every student.
Let's do some lightning round on this side. Maybe 30-second questions, and we'll try to get through as many as we can. Please.
What do you think the impact of the Leave No Child Behind has been, particularly the emphasis on testing? That should get to all of you.
It's had an impact, but the problem is it's a bread sandwich. It's standards and assessment, and they're not doing the teaching and learning, which is really the critical part of it. So it's a good beginning, but it's a long ways from getting done.
Tony, you've raised eyebrows.
Well, it'd be nice to have it funded.
And that's how you have the teaching and learning.
Right.
That's how you get the teaching and learning.
Otherwise, it just becomes yet another sort of pretend effort that then can validate the failure, which is not what we need to be validating.
We've talked a lot about increasing access and opportunities for disadvantaged kids to in education, in American education. But I think one of the biggest problems is depressed expectations for those kids. How do we ensure, and I'm talking particularly to Tony and Joel, how do we ensure that our educators expect equal things of all of their students?
I think this is a key, actually. Gus and I were talking about this before. This is a function of school leadership. And if you don't get school leadership right, you're never going to get the rest right. And effective school leaders do hold their communities to high standards, high expectations. And so one of the things we've done, we opened up about 150 new schools. Over 90% of the kids in those schools are small high schools, working with Bill Gates, paradoxically. He's given us well over $100 million to do this. And one of the things we've done is partner with groups like the College Board, like Outward Bound, and others. And one of the things that they're doing is really setting a different bar over which to jump. But that's indigenous to a small community. You can't do that. I exhort people all the time. I tell the story of a No Child Left Behind transfer student. Under No Child Left Behind, if your school is deemed failing, you can transfer. So I go see this kid because the prior year he was like doing nothing, and this year he's doing top work. I said, I don't get it. What happened between last year and this year? And he said it as well as you did, Kathy. He said, basically, he said, look, last year nobody expected anything of us. I didn't do anything. Around here, they expect everybody is going to get A's, so I figured I better get with the program, right? It's a classic example, but I could show it to you 1,000 times over. Bush's line in his inaugural about the subtle bigotry of low expectations is right. It's absolutely right in America today, and it has become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Tony, you raised a really good point when you talked about the fact that how do we begin to look at other people's children as all of our children? And the reason I raised that question is I work for a large foundation whose mission is to help children in foster care. And if you want to talk about abysmal rates of graduation from high school and from college, I mean, that is a population that you can identify that reaches that. Right now, only 3% of kids from foster care graduate from college. When you look at that rate compared to African Americans, Hispanics, or any other group, it is not that low. So I pose this question to you and to Joel. What can we do? Here we are, a large private foundation, $2 billion. We're ready to try and increase that rate. What are the strategies in terms of private and public sector collaborations in terms of what we can do to help expand those rates of graduation? I'm with the Casey Family Programs Foundation.
Well, first, let me thank the Casey Foundation. Has helped us with outreach. Generally, we have a telementoring system where we ask students who are on financial aid who come from less privileged backgrounds to be mentors to students around the country to think about what courses to take for college, how to apply for college, how to afford college, whether they choose to come to Amherst or not, and we think that's an important model that Casey is helping us to spread. I think within that model is part of the answer to the question, which is it's a pipeline. You can't solve the problem at the juncture from K-12 into university. It's too late at that point. We need to start at the beginning and follow it through. And an institution like Amherst, which again is a small institution, can say we're committed to that pipeline and we're looking for a small number of the very best of those students, A, because we think that's important in terms of leadership, but also because of the signaling effect that has that says you can succeed at the very highest level, and while not everyone will make it, you know, to that level, we need to show that it is possible to make it to that level and to follow them all the way through.
I think this woman nailed it. I think if we're going to change it, you've got to change it in the early years. And what you've got to do, particularly for kids who come from families and environments that are unstable, you have got to get them early, and you've got to keep them long hours and many months a year. What I would like to see for our highest needs kids is really 11-month-a-year schooling, and from 8 in the morning till 6 at night.
Please.
Hello, my name is Jesse Hassinger, and I'm a student at Baltimore City Public School System. And I have to say that some points were missed along the way. I felt Mr. Gaston brought up how his first teacher was his parent. And I don't think enough attention was called to the fact that education has to start at home with the parents, because you can't teach a kid who doesn't want to learn. So how can you get parents to get more involved if you can at all? Thank you.
I think it's an important point, but I'm going to answer it in the following way. We've spent a lot of time. We put in New York City schools, we put a parent coordinator in each and every school. Again, to me, I think all of us want to be great social engineers, but the action takes place at the school. Parents send their kids to a school. So we decided we'd invest about $45 million. In every school, we created this position. And there's much, much more outreach. We do our reading classes now. We'll have a Saturday reading class where the parents, some of them who can't read, some of them who have who are recent immigrants and don't speak language, we'll be doing a lot more of that. But I want to challenge your second premise. Teachers change lives. And some of my kids, for all intents and purposes, they have very little family involvement. That's the reality. And for us, I view us as the last line and the last chance for that kid. And teachers change the lives of kids. And if you have a way to really change the whole parent dynamic, that's great, and you should do everything you could. But you should also realize that there are kids in New York City who didn't want to learn until they met a teacher who just lit their fire for them, and we can do that.
Let's declare a hard stop after the three people who are standing here. So go ahead.
Okay, great panel. And I want to ask about the continuing viability of Brown versus Board of Education and of the project of school integration. I ask in part because the Supreme Court just took certiorari in two school cases involving whether or not we can continue to take race into account in school assignment. But perhaps more important than the constitutional issues, I want to ask you about the practical issues, the white flight to the suburbs that Tony referred to. And what's the continuing value of integration for black kids, for kids of color, and for white kids whose parents might want their kids to be educated in a multicultural environment?
Well, one of the things that I remember the last time I was here at Aspen, I think it was Justice Breyer over lunch explaining the clause in the Michigan decision about the 25 years. He sort of put it to me quite bluntly, sort of pointed his finger, and he said, you have about 10 years to solve this problem, because 10 years from now, a kid's going to enter the K-12 system who's going to not, if this timetable works or is reinforced, is not going to have any of the systems that we currently have in place. And that's a scary notion, because it's not clear to me that we're going to fully get there within those 10 years. But it's a challenge, but I'm not sure it's a challenge that everyone has heard fully, because there is this sort of American assumption that colorblind is the solution, even though we live in a society which is not colorblind. And so the danger is, before we've solved this problem, we're going to take away the mechanisms of solving it, as Kathy, you know from your own work.
Please.
Good morning. Stephen Horsford, State Senator from Nevada. Thank you for being here. And Chancellor, my question is directed at you. We tried to recruit Eric Nadelstern out to run our fifth largest school district in Clark County. But we were I came out to New York. I was very amazed by the programming. And it actually is a follow-up question to Mr. Bradley. We were talking about setting the bar and the expectation being suburban schools. Is that really the goal, since we are in a global society and there are kids that are doing even better outside of suburban schools? And the Bard High School is a perfect example of what kids are capable of graduating with liberal arts degrees from high school. So can you touch on that? What is the goal of public education? And is the goal really a suburban standard, or is it a global standard?
It's got to be a global standard. Our kids, as you know, are going to compete in a global economy. And we have, and I'm glad you mentioned this. This is an important point. We focused a lot on the achievement gap between whites and black and brown kids in America today. There's also an achievement gap between American kids and kids in many, many other countries throughout the world. And we need to be prepared to address that. And that's in part an issue of what Gaston has said. We've got to keep an eye on equity without losing a focus on excellence. The worst way to close the achievement gap is to bring down the top, right? We've got to push the top higher. some of the ways we're doing that, and I think the College Board deserves great credit. They are pushing this AP thing rigorously, and they need to push it even further. I've got too many kids in too many schools who are not being challenged enough, kids who are ready to play at the next level, and we need to take them to that next level.
One last question.
It's about funding. I wanted to know what more can be done. What methods are there to equalize the funding for poor, high-need inner-city schools with the suburban? Is it only through philanthropy, or are there other options?
Litigation.
There's a whole set of court cases pressing this. Litigation. Michael Rebell and his colleagues at Teachers College have been trying to coordinate that nationally, and it's starting to work, I think. Is that not right,
Joel? We're about to get, according to the latest court decision, somewhere around $5 billion a year. It's actually a very interesting question a woman asked about school desegregation. We've kind of come full circle on these issues, where for the longest time, we try to see if we could use desegregation and integration, busing, as a way to deal with some of these issues. Now we're going back toward, because of the suburban city split, we're going back toward, if you will, adequacy lawsuits that are being brought under state constitutions, so one in New York having one in our city. But the final point I'll leave you with is more money is essential, but more money poorly spent is not going to do the trick. And we've got to get smart about that.
Let me add one thing. One of the things we don't understand in America, for some reason, that education is a great investment. We think of it as an expense and not an investment. And any candidate you hear that says that you don't need to put money in education is against taxes. I mean, is against education and is not the friend of the people in this room.
I just say, I agree with that. And look, if we don't have an education system that says everyone has an equal chance going forward, those who need some extra help will get it, and then selects based on merit, then not only will our educational system be failing, but our society will falter. I mean, if you think about the sort of, forgive the analogies, to Rome at the end of its republic, if we have a system that doesn't provide opportunity and is rigged in various ways, that is the beginning of the end of the most, you know, of our power as a society. That's why these are crucial issues, why we have to face them together, and the responsibility of addressing the needs of all of our children, why their efforts are so impressive.
I want to take advantage of the moderator's chair. Take advantage of having the moderator's chair here for a moment to ask a question, but it has the advantage of being a rhetorical question. It's to Tony. Tony, you've organized a lot of your thinking around breaking down this elite hold on the very top so that others can come up into it. Amherst has had a hold at the top of the U.S. News and World Report scores for a while. I'm a Swarthmore grad, and I'm wondering, what can we do to break Swarthmore up into those ranks? Thank you all very much.